I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that has, wow, does it have contemporary relevance? It is important for our daily lives. Everything we do that involves energy is affected by U.S. energy policy. But it's not just a contemporary issue. It has historical roots. And we're going to talk about the development and current state of U.S. energy and U.S. energy policy with one of the foremost experts in the country on this question, Mark Mills. For those of you who don't know, Mark is contributing editor to City Journal, well-known publication, but now executive director of the National Center for Energy Analytics. His new book, The Cloud Revolution, is an extremely interesting look at the changes that are being affected right now in our society by the cloud revolution, as it suggests, and changing computer and other technology. So this is really going to be an interesting discussion today about energy, U.S. energy policy, and perhaps the connection with that and emerging technologies. Mark, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Great to join you. Thank you for the plug for my book. And yes, there is a connection between emerging technologies and energy. We could talk about that.
Sure. Let's start with your assessment of the current state of U.S. energy policy.
Well, let's do current state of U.S. energy and then policy.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because the reality is the United States retains a newly earned position, at least new in terms of the last half century or longer, is the world's number one producer of hydrocarbons, oil, gas, and coal. Excuse me. So we're the world's biggest producer, and as most of your listeners doubtless know, that's a relatively recent emergence because of the shale revolution, which is fundamentally a technology revolution. It's not a resource or discovery revolution. It's a technology revolution in the materials domains, some information technology in it. We are a major exporter of natural gas, second biggest in the world. Not just a producer, we are the biggest producer. We are a significantly robust state of the state of our grid is significantly robust, phrase it properly. That is, we don't have a grid, unlike a lot of countries. We have many grids, and that affords a particular benefit, both in terms of experimenting with how to operate grids, and also in terms of security and reliability, because there's no real single point of failure, unlike a lot of countries. There's no single grid. Even though people talk about the American grid, there isn't one, and fortunately. And it's in pretty darn good shape, despite all the rhetoric about it being a creaky grid. We're doing damage to it because of policies that are making it less reliable. And we're doing potential damage to our oil and gas industry because of policies that that are set to or about to or have started to impede efficient operations and expansion. And we are entering a potential era of policies that will damage the U.S. ability to be a significant player on the export market, because that's arguably the most critical second feature of energy domains. It's not just what we provide to ourselves, but what we can help the world with.
Well, it sounds then that maybe contrary to doom and gloom predictions from 50, 60 years ago, that we in fact have vast energy, not only vast energy production, but vast energy potential.
Yeah.
Take us back then 50 years ago, because some of our listeners obviously won't remember those times, but you've done such extensive research in that. You don't remember those times either, of course. Well,
embarrassingly so, I do. I was young, but I remember them.
People predicted very confidently the U.S. was going to run out of energy.
As any student of this domain knows, the first thing is that oil remains the sort of the political lead energy source, in the sense that markets don't like high oil prices. Politicians don't like high oil prices. Nothing frightens any politician more, both parties, than high-priced gasoline. President Biden twice engaged in Promethean efforts to keep gasoline prices from going up, despite, as we know, bragging about trying to effect a transition away from using oil, because no politician wants to be in charge, excuse me, if gas prices soar, gasoline prices. The reality is that in the world that we live in and how society operates and can operate, oil is used in 100% of every product or service somewhere, somehow. Not some, not most, not some percentage, but everything. Everything requires transporting goods and services and people, from mines and farms to factories and processing facilities, to warehouses, to doorsteps. And 99% of all global movement of goods and people is powered by oil burning machines. 1%, most of which is ethanol, is powered by non-oil. And the trivial, in terms of the total transportation ecosystem, electricity is like 0.25% of total transportation energy use. So it's an oil-centric reality. Transportation is essential to modern society. It's been essential to societies for all of history, but particularly modern society. If you don't have fuel for transportation, everything grinds to a halt, full stop. There's no exception to that rule. And so supply chains end, food stops moving, stops being produced. I emphasize that because the political impact of the 1973-74 oil embargo is explained by that fact. That embargo, for those who've forgotten their history, was implemented for political reasons by King Faisal to punish the United States for then assisting Israel in defending themselves against the attack of the Arab nations. And President Nixon at that time deployed intel from our satellites to help the Israeli Defense Forces. The U.S. was punished. That punishment, by embargoing shipment and sale of oil to the United States at a time when we were far more dependent, in fact, deeply dependent on imports, as we are not today, that had a catastrophic economic impact. It tripled, the price of oil tripled in a couple of months, 300% increase in oil prices. Imagine today what the political reaction would be if a similar political event occurred offshore that led to a 300% increase in the price of oil. It's tectonic, and it was then. So that oil shock led to the whole 50 years of the meme that we're running out of oil or running out of energy. We weren't running out of oil or energy. We weren't producing enough ourselves. It was a political event, not a geophysical event. It wasn't a storm, and it wasn't oil wells being exhausted. Yet, for 50 years, there's been this constant drumbeat that we have to worry about running out of energy or oil. Of course, what we have today is something very different. The world has demonstrated the capacity to produce all the oil that society needs, and far more than it needs, which is why oil prices are rather moderate. Even though they seem high, perhaps some people, they're technically inflation-adjusted terms, stayed pretty moderate. In fact, oil prices, aside from pretty wild gyrations episodically, are essentially, in inflation-adjusted terms, the same today as they were 40 years ago. Obviously, there are periods of higher prices and periods of collapse. But roughly speaking, if you look at an inflation-adjusted chart for oil prices, you see this oscillation, but it's the average is very similar. And so that what that has done is meant that the world has been able to use oil for transportation purposes, that have been ever more economically efficient because the underlying technical efficiency of combustion machines has gotten better and better and better. So I start with oil because while oil is a third of primary energy for the world, it's 100% essentially of our needs to make society operate. Electricity is similar, though a lot of things don't use electricity or don't use much, because you can use combustion technologies for many things. Technically, you don't need electricity to run a car. Use it to start, you know, for the electric starter motor. But, you know, for those who remember the car history, the first starter motors were your hand. You crank.
That's
you
right, crank cranking it yourself. Yeah.
The electric motor cranks the car. But so the state of play has been that we went from an era of the claim we were running out of oil, or we were permanently dependent on imports, depending on which camp, and sometimes we're the same camp, to an era now where we are exporters of both oil products and oil generally and natural gas. And prices are very moderate. In fact, they're very low for natural gas. And in fact, the essential thesis today in energy policy world is that we're using and producing too much oil. We're not running out of it. We are running out of the capacity to use it if you are, you know, worried about carbon dioxide emissions, because we have so much oil, there's no real limit to the society's appetite to consume it.
What has happened to cause the doomsday of we're running out of oil to become, oh, now we've got so much and too much by some people's? You talked about technological innovations. What are, for our listeners, what are some of those technological innovations that have really unleashed the not necessarily the oil supply, but making it the supply be able to meet demand, which I'm sure has gone up dramatically over the last 50 years?
You know, demand and supply of hydrocarbons broadly, oil, gas, and coal, have increased in the last 25 years alone, so the 21st century, by an amount equal to 6 Saudi Arabia's worth of oil production.
Wow.
So it's a very big increase in hydrocarbon production. The share of global energy supplied by hydrocarbons is slightly lower, about 2 percentage points, but on a much bigger pie. So we've added a lot of other things, not just biofuels, but mostly wind and solar, have made us a non-trivial dent in global electricity supply. From an energy perspective, all the spending, certainly trillions of dollars of spending globally on wind and solar, have brought the world to a point where those two new sources of energy supply about 3.5% of global energy, primary energy, which is not nothing, but you know, you don't have to be a mathematician to know that 3.5% is not a big number. And for perspective, burning wood globally still supplies the world almost 10% of all energy. So wood burning is still a bigger energy source than all the world's windmills and solar panels combined. It's pretty remarkable. So the reason I say those facts is, of course, the context, the answer to your question, what happened? Because in most people's minds, technology progress has brought us lithium batteries, windmills, and solar panels, and they have. And that progress has meant that there are now things today compared to 25 years ago that weren't possible then. Wind and solar are far more cost-effective now than they were then. Electric cars are now possible and cost-effective in a certain demographic, in a certain car class. So the high-cost car class, the expensive car, luxury car, it's, you know, EVs are competitive with other luxury cars, simply put. They're not competitive with most cars, but they're competitive with luxury cars. And that's a very big market in the wealthy world. It's a very, very big market, the wealthy world, as Elon Musk knows better than anybody else. And
right.
But the technology changes that have come to wind and solar and batteries have doesn't meant that there haven't been technology changes in natural gas and oil and coal. There's been tremendous incremental improvements, both how we produce, transport, and use hydrocarbons. The single most remarkable thing in the oil market, because that's, again, the political lightning rod for energy, it has been, because it's, in a sense, the one that everybody sees the most transparently. It's not, it's obvious to you when you fill your car up how much oil you use and what it costs. It's less obvious when you get your electric bill, because there's so many other things consuming the electricity in your house, and you get the bill monthly. It'd be the equivalent of getting your electric bill as frequently as you pay for gasoline when you're traveling. And that would be inconvenient, but that would give you more reflexive transparency on what's going on in the electric market. So we don't emotionally have that reflex. And also, you know, you can easily do things to conserve electricity. You can choose to turn your air conditioner warmer, choose to not to do things. It's hard to do that with your car. You can't choose not to go to work easily, and you can't easily change the car you have to get a more efficient one. So oil has this very dramatic and unique political, economic, and social feature to it because of cars. So the technology in the oil supply side, of course, is, you know, famously, or depending on where you are politically, infamously attached to the so-called fracking revolution, hydraulic fracturing of shale rocks, which geologists have known have been there and full of oil for a century. So they weren't discovered recently. What was perfected recently is the combination of techniques, materials science, in information science. It's not one thing. The ability to drill horizontally and stimulate, which is the engineer's term for fracturing microscopically these deep rocks so they release gas and oil. All those techniques didn't come about because of one specific discovery. It's not the equivalent of saying, I invented the transistor, now that I can make computers and radios smaller. There's no equivalent invention in the energy market. It's not the equivalent of the invention of the solar photovoltaic cell, which made, of course, solar power more feasible. What we have is a sort of a complex mix of continual and significant improvements across these engineering domains of material science. The experience itself, all businesses get better with experience. And with more knowledge, we actually understand how to stimulate that rock. And that's the important part. The fact that there was oil and gas in the shale rocks was well known. It's called source rock. It's where the oil and gas come from that over geological time, the compression of the earth squeezes that oil and gas out into pockets that we drill into and you get that pressurized oil and gas. So the technology progress looked like it was an overnight thing because the political and media class suddenly noticed there was a lot of activity in the shale fields of America. But it had been going on for decades prior to that. And it came to a sort of an apotheosis of capabilities. People began to imitate and emulate. And in the United States, of course, we have another feature in energy markets, which is totally unique in the world, utterly unique globally. Citizens own the mineral rights below the land that they owned. We're the only country in the world that that's true. It's in the Constitution. What that means is that when an oil or gas company or a mining company, anybody wants to use minerals below your land, they have to pay you a royalty, the landowner. That creates sort of a virtuous circle of incentives between landowners and minerals producers that is unique in the world. If you live anywhere else and somebody drills under your land to get oil or gas, you get nothing for that. You're not particularly inconvenienced because you can drill horizontally, but you get nothing. You can imagine the difference if everybody in the world that sat above property that produced oil and gas were paid a royalty by an oil and gas company. But you can emulate the equivalent of that. Most countries extract a royalty fee, as does ours, from oil and gas producers, but that goes to the government. Mineral rights owners don't have to have the government as an intermediary to decide if they get the money. They get the money. So you have that unique feature in America. Another unique feature in America, it's not as totally unique, but close to as mineral rights, is our capital markets. Nowhere in the world are there so many private funds, banks, and players in capital markets, the businesses in the business of loaning money, businesses in the businesses of investing money on the part of other investors. We have the largest, most fluid, you could argue chaotic capital market in the world. So you take that combination of mineral rights, unique, capital markets that are unique, not a unique, but a unusually resource-rich geology of the United States. China and Russia have big shale fields, as does Argentina. Why don't they have the shale production that we have? Well, we have the other three things. We have free capital markets. We have free citizens who enjoy the economic benefit. We have a very free engineering market. So we have thousands of firms in the United States, businesses, thousands and thousands of them, involved in the oil and gas industry. The big super majors, which is what everybody writes about politically, have a relatively small role in American oil and gas production. The super majors produce about 25% of U.S. oil and gas.
I think that would be very surprising to our listeners. They think it's ExxonMobil. They think it's right. Chevron. They think it's British Petroleum. They think those are the folks, whenever there's discussion in the media or policymakers, right. It's almost always focused on those very large producers.
Big oil, right? The invective of big oil. Now, those are big companies in there, and they, of course, operate globally, and they are bigger producers overall than U.S. small independents. But domestically, the industry we're talking about, the United States, the shale revolution, it was born of the independents. Some of the big guys like Exxon bought some of the independents, as has Chevron and others, and that'll keep happening. And they are big players as well. But the interesting fact is we got there because of the free market for capital, the free market for ownership, and frankly, and I'm beating this free market thing to death, the fact that a bunch of entrepreneurs were competing with each other to do this thing we call hydraulic fracturing is very different than a corporate VP deciding they're going to do something specific, right? That can be just as effective as a small company when you're doing something you already know how to do, or even more effective. But it's very different when you're trying to experiment and do new things. That's where open in markets with competition work better. The other thing that's changed in the world, it's almost as big a factor, and it's about to become a bigger factor, is deep water, offshore deep water, globally. So this is where we get the super majors. Most of the, the independents, this is not their primary focus. It's land side. There are independents offshore as well. But Exxon, Mobil, Shell, Chevron, Hess, all these big companies have become extraordinarily more productive and efficient at doing offshore exploration and production. I mean, they have done things, again, because of advances in material science, in information science, using computing modeling to design and control construction. So the kinds of offshore platforms that would take 10 years to build, cost $1 billion, they're now building in 5 years and putting into production, cutting the time in half. In any business, you cut the time in half, that has a out of proportion reduction in the cost of capital, because time is not your friend when it comes to spending a lot of capital. This has been a very big deal. If you were sort of dividing the world up into oil production, and you had the United States and OPEC, the third biggest oil producing region, slightly bigger than the United States and OPEC, is offshore.
Wow.
If it were a country. But it's not, obviously, many countries have state-owned offshore, but that gives you a sense of how important offshore production is and will be. That's new in the last 20 or 30 years. So those two together, offshore, which is many, many countries, and the super majors, and state-owned oil companies, and the U.S., changed the game. We oversupply the world, basically, with oil. We don't oversupply the world. The resource production concentration has decreased. Not enough, in my opinion. So OPEC's dominance remains the largest single producer. Saudi Arabia is not the biggest single producing country. We are, but OPEC collectively is an organization that can do things we can't do legally in the United States, which is openly conspire for oil price. It's illegal to openly conspire or secretly conspire control price of a product in America. But OPEC was formed specifically to manage prices because they're not subject to our laws. And you can understand why they would do that. But when it comes to the energy world, that's sort of the reality is that we have a domain where there is, to use an expression from an old political campaign, there is no controlling authority for oil prices in America. But
right.
There is a controlling authority for oil prices, an attempt to have a controlling authority globally because of OPEC's outsized role in deciding to turn on or turn off production. So it's the dynamic has geopolitical implications, has economic implications. But the bottom line is oil remains incredibly important. Oil is going to remain incredibly important for the foreseeable future, for as far into as we can see. So that's just me saying that. International Energy Agency says that. In different words, by the way. They have tenacious words, but they're saying the same thing. No one who has a serious understanding of the dynamic of global energy markets believes that we're not going to have massive requirement for oil and gas for the foreseeable future. There's debate about how big, is it going to stay at roughly 60% of world's energy, that's for oil and gas, or will it be 50%, or will it be 62%, or 48%? I don't think it's going to be below 50, but let's just say the people who believe that are right. That still begs the question, where does half of the world's energy come from if we're not a major player? Even if you believe it's possible to accelerate hydrogen production and ethanol production and biodiesel and all these things that are being proposed to abandon hydrocarbons, even if you believe all those things can be done economically and tolerably, you still don't end up getting rid of the need for massive quantities of oil and gas, which sort of brings us back to, we're in the same place now as we were in the 70s and 80s
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because you made it. I mean, this is really fascinating. It's clear that because of the shale revolution, because of the offshore advances, and as you say, our capital markets, our mineral rights, the United States and other places, though, have been able to expand oil and gas production very dramatically to keep pace with the growing world economy. And it helped to fuel that, actually. But you mentioned at the outset, notwithstanding that, there are some possible policy changes that have begun or are beginning or may begin soon that could have a dramatic effect on the situation. And I take it a dramatic negative effect on the situation. Yeah. What are two or three for our listeners of the most important of those?
Well, I could put it in very simple ways, a movement to oppose the construction of pipelines. If you mount efforts, which environmental groups have, it has been supported by many state governments supporting environmental organizations and our federal government, Keystone Pipeline being the poster child for that. Opposition to construction of oil and gas pipelines is the easiest way if you want to throttle U.S. oil and gas production and output. You take away offtake. If you can't get the oil and gas out of the fields to where it needs to go, you can do it by train and truck, but not cost effectively, not at the scales you do with pipelines. Pipelines are an incredibly inexpensive and energy efficient and environmentally efficient way to move energies, and by far and away the most economically efficient and safe and environmentally sound way to move energy, even better than electric transmission lines when you do an all-in accounting. Nothing comes close to the incredible efficiency using a pipe. But if you ban pipes, make it hard to build them, you constrain oil and gas production, not just exports, but production, because it has to leave. Even though when the Keystone Pipeline wasn't finished, in North Dakota moved a lot of oil on trains and rail cars until they got the more pipes built, and then they stopped using the trains. But you can do that. There's a limit to that. It's more expensive by a factor of about 5 to 10 per barrel of oil equivalent. So it costs about 50 cents a barrel of oil to maybe a buck to move it in a pipeline, and it costs $5 to as much as $10 a barrel of oil to move it on a train. It's a big increase in costs. So pipeline, number one. Number two, export terminals. Because the United States is completely and totally self-sufficient, this is remarkable. We're in hydrocarbons. We're an energy exporter. So the only place on the margin net new production can go is to other people, you know, at the macroeconomic level, which means you need more LNG terminals, more LNG ships, and more oil terminals, and more oil ships carrying the product to the world. So if you make it hard to build terminals or hard to export, or in the case of what the Biden administration did a few months ago famously, which was put a quote pause on export of LNG permits to building the new terminals, that chills the market, because people building multi-billion dollar facilities get nervous if there's capricious moves to halt permits to export. So that had the effect that was intended. And this is, again, not me. I'm not making a political statement. I'm making a policy statement. People may agree that Biden should do that, but it's a fact that by doing so, you chill the market, no pun intended, since LNG is a chilled gas. So opposing terminals, right? Opposing pipes, very effective levers if you want to damage, constrain U.S. oil and gas production. The third one would be to impose new environmental regulations that are difficult to impossible to accommodate. In other words, will make it difficult to impossible to expand production. So, for example, there's been a proposal circulated for some time by the Environmental Protection Agency to ratchet down what they call the ozone standard, attainment standard, say, across the country, such that whole regions of oil and gas production would become legally, quote, non-attainment zones. And, of course, if you do that, if you become a zone where your normal business of operation currently meets an environmental regulation, but I change the regulation so you're not meeting it, well, it's pretty obvious. Even if you don't make it a retroactive rule to shut down what exists, which is, to my knowledge, not the proposal, but it could do that. Politicians could do whatever they want. But making it a prospective rule would mean that you might see some very significant reductions in drilling activity and exploration, and therefore investment. So, you know, broadly speaking, you know, it distills to regulatory and policy impediments that will constrain offtake, export, and your ability to drill, which I will say again has been the stated goal of many environmentalists. This is not, we're not speculating about whether that's the goal. The goal has been to throttle the ability of the United States to produce and export oil and gas. And so, it could be done. I mean, politics, you know, governments are powerful. They can do these things.
Right. Well, all right. If we're asking you, if we're asking Mark Mills, give us, because I'm sure our listeners are thinking, all right, then what's the alternative? How could we have economically and environmentally sound energy production so that we have, you know, that it remains inexpensive or even it becomes increasingly inexpensive, unleash American production in an environmentally sound way? If Mark Mills was in charge, what would some of the most important reforms be that we could do?
Well, first, we should, I think it's worth context again why they're important reforms, because to go back to where I started, there is no vision, no possibility that the world's not going to need a lot more hydrocarbons. So the most important broad policy goal of any administration, in my view, and so my recommendation would be to implement whatever policies are required to ensure the reliable production by us as a force for good in the world at the lowest possible cost, because low-cost energy means that there's more money available for other things like healthcare, like environmental protection, like our military. So making energy more expensive when it doesn't have to be necessarily increases debts and decreases liquid capital for things that we all care about. And it's unavoidable. It's just a simple fact. You want energy to be free. That's the goal. And you want it to be perfectly reliable and free. That would be what history has worked towards, or lowest possible cost at the highest possible reliability, geopolitical and physical reliability. So that, in my mind, is a central goal of policy. I think it's a central moral goal. The reason that humanity, especially the Western world, enjoys the luxuries we enjoy is not just because of the spin-off economic benefits of low-cost transportation, air travel, pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceutical industry is one of the most energy-intensive industries in the world. It's comparable energy intensities like steelmaking and aluminum. It's a very energy-intensive product. No one questions the need for pharmaceuticals. Why would we want to make them more expensive for anybody in the world? So if you take those as the premises, and the third premise is that there is no future without lots of oil and gas being needed. The debate about how much is an interesting debate. You know, how much will it grow, or might it shrink a little? Perfectly reasonable debate. But the debate has shifted to we should do without it. We should have none. We should accelerate its decline. This is extraordinarily dangerous. So my premise to answer your question is you have to start with that we have to have it. It's not discretionary. Needs to be reliable, which is geopolitical and physical realities about reliability. And it needs to be as cheap as possible. How do you achieve that? Well, we got the question answered. We know the answer because we answered the question the last 20 years. oil has remained very cheap, it's abundant. And how did that happen? Well, by and large, markets have functioned relatively well, relatively unfettered. That is, we haven't abandoned regulations of the oil and gas industry. No one during the shale revolution suggested that they should pollute the water or air. None of that happened. So I would just say in simplest terms, do again what we did last time. Replicate the conditions in broad policy terms that allowed the ascendance of the United States to become the world's largest oil and gas producer. Because technically, and in resource terms, we could double again. We could do that technically. It's whether it's economically viable or whether regulators would permit it are two related but different questions.
The potential is that large.
Potential is enormous. So what does that mean? Well, that means, I guess, to cut to the elephant in the room, it means that you can't put carbon dioxide emissions as the single criteria that drives everything. If governments make reducing carbon dioxide emissions of the United States the single criteria for all energy policy, that will be economically destructive and it won't reduce global CO2 emissions. The reason I can conclude those two things is easy to illustrate. We know it's economically destructive because there are no sources of new energy at the scale society needs that are as affordable as oil, gas, and coal by factors of 2 to 10. That's indisputable. The debate, again, is over whether we can reduce the penalty over hydrocarbons, not whether there isn't a penalty. There's an economic penalty that's being justified, as you know, by climate models talking about future harms. It's fine. We can have that, but we have to have that debate on the basis of economic costs to the present, which is essentially what the debate's about. The second part, I can say with confidence, that whatever we choose to do in the United States, whether it's to unleash our oil and gas industry or to throttle it and redirect precious economic resources to providing less reliable, more expensive energy from alternatives, which we can technically do. Could be wrong. You could do a lot more than we're doing. It would just cost a lot and be environmentally land destructive and resource using. You know, wind, solar, and batteries use lots of land and use lots of mineral resources. But the world's CO2 emissions won't go down because of that. We know that because, as an example, it's just one example, China has under construction hundreds of new coal plants right now, new ones. When those are completed in the next few years, the additional CO2 emissions from just those additional coal plants will be greater than all the CO2 emissions reductions that are being claimed to come from $2 trillion of spending on the Inflation Reduction Act. So let me say it again. We'll spend $2 trillion to reduce CO2 emissions in the United States. And it's possible that emissions will go down in the United States if we do that. That's clearly the case. Not to zero, but it'll go down. But that reduction will be wiped out by one country's new coal plants. And that doesn't count new coal plants in India or Indonesia or anywhere else in South Asia. And all those countries are building those coal plants. Not maybe, not theoretically, not planned. They're under construction. So we will not, by impoverishing ourselves, lead to a global reduction in CO2 emissions. So the debate about energy policy, it's a long answer to what three things would I do. I would say there'd be four things, the three things that are impediments, the three things that will unleash it are not adding unnecessary onerous regulations, rationalizing regulations that are irrational. There's a lot of irrational regulations that can be cleaned up that will increase the velocity of production without increasing environmental damage or oversight. It's just it's a rat's nest, if you like. Regulations. Surely we can do better. We've demonstrated we can do better in other industries. And then we have to stop acting as if the only metric for all energy policy is carbon dioxide, which is essentially what's going on. It's a economically destructive preoccupation, again, which says nothing about whether the science is good, bad, or indifferent. It is a simple fact of economics and physics that we are not able to, nor have we been, reducing CO2 emissions globally anywhere from any policies, regardless of how much money has been spent. And a lot of money has been spent. So it's difficult to imagine we'll do that we're going to get rational energy policies look like they were, say, 20, 25 years ago. Even though those were not perfect, they were better than today. But I do think that we can end up pushing back towards more of a compromise where in the political sphere that we live in, political compromises are always necessary. Those who feel much more emotionally attached to wind and solar and EVs, I like all of them. I like electric cars. I like windmills. I just don't like the asymmetry and the subsidies. I think it's very bad and economically destructive. So we don't have to say it's a political solution that we are shutting down windmills the way the counterparty says we have to shut down oil wells. That's a silly position. It's you have to rationalize production economically based on what the world really is in fact doing. And what it's in fact doing is consuming more oil and gas. Surely it's a sort of central matter of policy. There's an easy organizing principle. The United States should adopt and policies that lead to us having an increasing role in supplying the world the oil and gas it needs, because that's good for our economy. It's good for our geopolitics, because global stability should be self-evident to state in our current times, is a goal that has never gone away. And we're not a player if we're not a supplier.
And would you suggest, because U.S. energy production is more energy efficient and cleaner, it would also, if the U.S. is the major producer, is that environmentally better as well?
Well, sure, of course. Yes, the answer is yes, but many other countries, Canada is a big producer, Norway is a big producer of oil and gas. I dare say Iran, which is nominally or episodic, obviously, enemy, their oil and gas production is pretty efficient and pretty clean. I mean, they're not interested in destroying their environment. Even the Russians, who we like to vilify now, we used to be our partners and our enemies, but that's geopolitics of history. And they're appropriately, I'm not trivializing that they are appropriately vilified for invading Ukraine. I'm just talking about the long stretch of the last half century. Russia has gone from being our enemy to our friend, our enemy to friend. We go through these cycles, but Russia, as an operator of oil and gas assets, has not demonstrated any appetite for despoiling its environment and operating the systems inefficiently. Their systems are pretty darn efficient because they're our systems, our companies until recently, and multinationals are the ones that built them and helped them do what they're doing. So I know the argument you make is an argument that's often made, and it's fine, but I don't think it's a particularly persuasive one in the sense that by comparison, if we compare to how oil and gas was produced in the 1920s, sure, but very few people do that globally. This is not the way the world really operates, especially given the ubiquity of our industry and raising standards around the world.
Right, right. Yeah. All right. Looking forward, and maybe this is an unfair question, but when thinking about U.S. energy policy, U.S. energy production, and thinking about benefits to the world of a modern economy, are you hopeful when you think about U.S. and world energy production and policy or not?
No, I do the caveat again, depends on time frames.
I'm thinking the next 10 to 20 years, the kind of time frame that our listeners, are thinking in.
Sure, 10 to 20 years, very hopeful, because reality is already demonstrating it resurfaces. We put it at the website of my new think tank, the National Center, for Energy Analytics. You'll find, if you go there, there's a quote from Philip K. Dick, science fiction writer, who wrote stories and novels that made, for example, the Minority Report movie that was so popular and famous. He said, I'm paraphrasing, reality is that which, when you ignore it, still exists. So the reality of what energy can do and can't do is becoming obvious. The sort of the bloom is off the rose, EVs taking over the world, not because EVs aren't nice, it's because the myth that they're simpler, cheaper, more reliable is not true. They're very similar vehicles and more expensive than conventional cars, but they aren't inherently cheaper to make. They aren't inherently safer. They aren't inherently more reliable. They're different fuel in many ways and similar in others, but that's becoming obvious, right? Hertz CEO lost his job over the obviousness of that. The reason that he got fired was because he bought about $300 million worth of Teslas and discovered that he had to sell most of them because it was more expensive to maintain them than their conventional cars they had. So will that always be the case? EVs will get more reliable over time, but that's normal engineering. My point is, we're learning that about windmills and solar power and grid reliability, global gas, natural gas demand's up, global oil demand is up, global air travel is back at pre-pandemic levels and growing rapidly. Global computer use has now got on headlines correctly, something I've been writing about for two decades, is a major source of electricity consumption. The single biggest new source of electricity consumption is global computing. Bigger than EVs by a factor of 10, by the way.
Wow. And so, that's not going away.
It's growing faster than EVs by a lot. So all that means that when you economies and people want the things, you began by saying energy is used in everything, because energy is used in everything, not some things. As economies want to expand, they not only need more energy, economies and people want the energy to be cheaper. They want it to be more reliable and cheaper, both. That redounds to the reality that hydrocarbons will play a central role, if not dominant role, for a very, very long time. That's just reality. Not the only role, that's a reality. Reality is being demonstrated by the consequences of decisions that sort of are based on naive PowerPoint claims about how systems can operate as opposed to how real systems operate in the real world. So this is already, the evidence is already before us that reality is resetting policy expectations, even in Germany. You know, they're expanding coal burning, not windmills, to keep their grid reliable. What they should do is turn them back on their nuclear plants, obviously, but that reality is in full force in Europe and in Germany. They can ignore it for a while, but it eventually has economic and social consequence. So I'm very optimistic that we, especially in the United States, you know, U.S. has a long history that's been stated in many, many ways by different, you know, political philosophers, that we have the luxury, because of our wealth and the diversity of our geography and our people and our industries, of trying a lot of things out. We can afford to try things out that don't work and then go back to what works. It's essentially what we've been doing in our energy market. We've been trying some stuff out at great cost. It's not destructive in the broad sense. I mean, it offends me to waste $1 trillion. It's a lot of money to spend on something. But you still learn stuff, and the $1 trillion provides energy. It's more expensive, but it's in the context of a $24 trillion economy. We can afford that. Very few countries, including China, by the way, have the economic resilience and depth and scale all combined at the United States. So I think the experiment has been tried. I think its flaws are clear. Some of its benefits are more clear. And reality will prevail. So I'm very optimistic we'll see both a strong U.S. economy, but also a growing U.S. economy, increase petroleum and gas exports over time. Will that happen in the next 4 years? A lot will depend on the election in November, because the bifurcation and the policy positions, it's stronger now than at any time in my living memory of the two political parties in the United States, at least. And I think it's unfortunate, because there are things that we can agree to argue about that we'll say are not material to our economic health. But we're now arguing about things that are material to our economic health in the short term. So we could be destructive in the short term. We could follow Germany and the United Kingdom down a path to a greater energy inflation and the destruction of the budgets of poor and middle-class families, which is what's happening there, and the deindustrialization of that continent. You know, Europe's on track to becoming just one giant Disneyland, where its primary industry is tourism, because as you deindustrialize, I mean, Europe tourism is way up this year. The data are already in. Germany, which is the industrial anchor of Europe, has deindustrialized. Its industrial output is affirmatively and significantly down, and not just because of Putin and the gas issue, but because of policies that the German government made to make energy expensive and less reliable. So industries are not expanding, and some are leaving. The United States could do that. China and India could pick up the slack. Indonesia could pick up the slack. Even some African nations in oil and gas production. There's oil and gas everywhere. I mean, Namibia just had a big, big discovery offshore. Guyana and the south part of the Caribbean is a massive new producing field. So it will be produced somewhere by somebody. We will Oil and not just oil, but steel and aluminum will be produced somewhere by somebody. We can choose to be in that ecosystem or not. So I am very optimistic, pretty confident that the general direction of the American electorate is as they learn that these are the actual choices, we'll choose the right path, in my mind, which is not deindustrialization, but reindustrialization. So the political parties have sort of agreed on that, as you know, these policies to reshore American industry. I'm all in. I'm not fully on board with how we're going about it. You have to ask why industries left to figure out why, how you get them back. Offering people money to come back, but still brutalizing them with regulations and making it take 10 years to build a factory instead of 2 years, they're not going to come back. So you have to think about why they left in the first place. In many cases, they left because we chased them away with punitive regulations. So what hasn't happened yet is a reforming of the regulations that drove industries away, especially mining, for example. So, but again, I think we'll reform that because we're having that debate now. We haven't had that debate. I don't know. I mean, I worked for a mining company as a young man in Canada. I love mines and miners and mining. We haven't had a vigorous debate about the importance of U.S. mining, again, in my living memory. And now we're having it. This is great. This is great because that means maybe we'll do something sensible about it. Not perfect, but perfect, you know that old adage that perfect is the enemy of good enough. We'll do something good enough. So I'm very optimistic. And when you combine that with the trends that I have covered in my book, so my book at the end, as you know, in the epilogue, I declare this the American century, not China's century. And I didn't make that as a jingoistic claim. It's a claim based on the factors I just described, but also the fact that the confluence of emerging technologies that are cloud-centric, next-generation automation, next-generation material science, which are amplified by AI and the cloud, the constellation of technologies that are now emerging all redound to the probability of a asymmetric increase in our GDP and growth, somewhat similar. I made this claim in my book, but I still think it's true. Somewhat similar to what happened in the 1920s. There was an asymmetric uptick in our ability to be productive as an economy because of the kinds of technologies that emerged in the 1920s. We have a similar class of technologies emerging in the 2020s. And I think it'll have the same effect. It will mean more energy gets consumed. It'll make it easier to produce it cleanly. But that's sort of, to me, the second order issue. What I was more interested in my book, what I'm more personally interested in, is the first order effect, which is making everybody in America wealthier and safer, which that shouldn't be a partisan political objective. The partisanship goes in how you achieve that. But I think whatever we do for policies to achieve it, we do live in a unique pivot in history where the opportunities to affect unusual and asymmetric growth are really arriving and with us. So, and I'm optimistic that will become obvious, just like the energy realities have become obvious. Computing is a sort of a central force of our society, become obvious. None of this is to be a Pollyanna. There's no downsides like to computing and social media. There's been downsides to everything throughout all of human history. But underlying that, I have a deep sense of optimism, which is clearly reflected in my book. My biggest worry is just rely on how long it takes for us to rediscover reality and how much economic and social damage is done by making really, really bad decisions that we'll have to wait a few years to discover how bad they were in a reverse course.
That seems to be a consistent trend thinking about American history and thinking about public policy. But yeah. Wow, what a fascinating, let me recommend Mark Mill's book, The Cloud Revolution. What a fascinating, insightful, thought-provoking conversation. Mark, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.